ระหะโทสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะพุทธังธัมมังสังฆังนะมัสสามิ
So I wish to welcome everyone. And this subject for today, stress, is, it's always a subject that a lot of people are interested in, because I think of modern life and pressures of life create this feeling. Because you hear the word being used all the time. In fact, when I was a child, I don't remember hearing it very much. People maybe had another word. And it seems in the past 20, 30 years that word stress is seems to be the expression for what we create in our lives. Through living as a human being in a social situation, in a family, in a society. Or we can even live alone and feel stressed. Because we don't have, it doesn't have to even be blamed on anyone else. And so the Buddhist way is always to contemplate, you know, what is stress, not as some abstract expression, but to begin to I'm going to be stressed, really. Maybe that would be more helpful if I sit here and get stressed and you can just watch. But I'm sure you want to know from me all the answers how to deal with stress. Because you probably think Buddhist monks are beyond it. Or somebody like me who's been a monk for so long and should be stress-free. But then recognizing the way things are, because the Buddha's teaching is pointing at the way things are, you know, the existential reality of being human. And of course, you know, we can, you know, we're aware that we are human, but sometimes we don't really take into account what that really means. Like consciousness itself and the experience of consciousness and sense experience, because we have retentive memory, then we can endlessly worry about the future. Even though everything might be going along very well at this moment, we think we can start anticipating disasters or problems arising in the future because of our memory. So this is this realm we live in, being born, is stressful. And growing up and getting old, the whole process is always involves stress. So this can also be aligned with the First Noble Truth the Buddha taught of the truth about suffering or dukkha, or you can even substitute the word stress. Because the sensory experience is one of that we have not that much control over. We're born into a world where we are going to be irritated, frustrated, agitated by the things that happen to us from the time we're born to the time we die. And that's just the way it is. When you recognize this, it being having a human body, male or female, young or old, that it is in continuous contact with things. You know, even if you try to shut the world out, control everything as much as you can to avoid unpleasant impingement, it's still from inside we can create stress. Outside, because that's just the way it is. In modern life, I think the thing that kind of emphasizes it or makes us more aware of stress maybe than any time before, is because this is just my way of expressing it, is because of the speed of which we live. We live in a time where everything is accelerated. And so we don't have periods of great relaxation and rest and where we can just completely relax and let go. Due to our cleverness and our brilliance, we can create all kinds of machines and computers and all kinds of fantastic technology that we're quite good at inventing. And of course, this speeds everything up. Our experience of life isn't kind of in harmony with the flow and rhythms of nature, but it's accelerated. So we want instant gratification. We sometimes lack the development of patience because we can get what we want more immediately, more quickly than ever before. In societies that don't have high level technology, or even if you're old enough to remember, even when the West wasn't so stressed out, there was we're more in the flow of life with the seasonal changes and the days and nights, the phases of the moon. And these, one adapted one's life, or one lived a life more kind of in harmony with the natural movements of the planets, the seasons, and so that life had a texture to it that tended to, say, calm us, that had a natural calming influence over us, that I can say now is hard to find. Because of we can live a life, a totally artificial life. Like here in England, one can live in a city like London and be completely cut off from almost all the natural phenomena. As you live in a flat and centrally heated, air-conditioned, everything is electric. One can go, you know, from a heated building into a heated car into the office where it's already warm, and go back home and enter the house. So your experiences with just the weather can be very minimal. One now with the computer, we can live in the virtual reality, live in a world where we can have everything as we want. Like one. Somebody was describing, we were discussing what kind of monastery each of us would have if we could have our own way. And one monk honestly said, well, virtual reality monastery. And it's the first time I ever thought of that. I thought, that sounds pretty good, actually. So here I create the perfect monastery. And I've never been able to create the perfect monastery. I remember when I first started out years ago in Thailand, and we started Wat Phananachat. And of course, then I was much younger, and I also thought I was going to really, you know, create the perfect monastery according to my ideals. Didn't take me long to see I've never been able to do that. But of course, the ideal, isn't it, of how a good monastery should be is one way. You know, we can have this image, this vision, and then the realities of life, as it happens to be, you know, which are never perfect. And when they are, they can't stay that way. Like I noticed here in living in England, that I comment on people complain about the weather all the time here. So one time I was just reflecting, I said, you know, some of the most perfect days I've ever spent in my life, I remember, have been here in England. And they looked at me totally surprised. Because I think the memory tends to hold on to it's rainy and wet and cold. So you don't even notice a perfect day when you're right in the middle of it. It doesn't register. You know, so when there are perfect, weather-wise, I mean, you know, where it's neither too hot nor too cold and everything just seems, you know, you couldn't really improve on it in terms of a vision. Except that on this perfect, this peak experience, you might spoil it by wishing that you could have it all the time. Or, you know, I think if you move to another place, you might find a place where there's perfect weather you could experience every day of your life. So even in the midst of a perfect moment, we can create stress by recognizing that we can't sustain it. It's impossible to bend life or control situations and hold them according to our wishes or our desires. So the Buddha pointed to this, this way that we can, as human beings, can create suffering and stress, even when we're the most fortunate of human beings. Just being able to see, you know, having vision, and hearing sounds and smelling odors, tasting things, feeling heat and cold, pleasure and pain through every part of the body. This is the sense world around us is always challenging us in some way. It's always an irritation on us. So consciousness is the experience of conditions that are changing. And though if we're unconscious, then we would never notice. But because we are conscious beings, this means that we're living in a realm where we can just recognize it. It's like this. It's a sense realm, a realm where we have very little control and we can't make it into what we want, but it is the way it is. Human beings are wonderfully adaptable, so that they can adapt to whatever kind of conditions they have to put up with, when you think of it, and look at your own life. How, you know, just one can adapt to the most unpleasant physical experiences, or limitations, or disabilities, or extremes of heat and cold, to different types of diet, food, and the experiences of life, of success and failure, and being with the loved, and losing one's loved ones. These are experiences that all human beings have in their lifetime, and yet we adapt to it. So we have this reflective ability, we have an amazing capacity to respond to life, and through these conscious forms that we're incarcerated in. And so it's learning to recognize and understand ourselves, that we are liberated from suffering. So in the Buddha's teaching of Nibbana, or the liberation from suffering. It doesn't mean like an enlightened being or the Buddha himself, if we should even care to read the history of the Lord Buddha, that he was not liberated from the stress of life that was just natural to this situation. After his enlightenment, the Buddha had to endure all kinds of stressful situations. You read in the scriptures, they tried to kill him. He was ridiculed and blamed for things he never did. He had to put up with difficult bhikkhunis, enemies, and all kinds of terrible situations that I've never had anything. Nobody's tried to murder me yet. I've never had to deal with a drunken elephant. And I should think that would be very stressful. So even becoming enlightened or even being the Buddha does not get us out of the predicament. But the attitude changes, say, from enlightened attitude to an ignorant one. Now the ignorant one means that we don't contemplate our lives at all. We just try to control things or make things or blame our suffering on others or endlessly grumble and complain about life if it gets too stressful. Or always running away, trying to find happiness or something that will make us feel less stressed by seeking people or situations or even isolation to get away from it. So I remember when I was a new monk, I found life in the monastery in Thailand, Ajahn Chah's monastery, I found it's too stressful sometimes, so I went off to this place in the northeast in Sukhumvit province. So this ideal place where I would be pretty much alone. There were two other monks with me, two Thai monks, and it's quite a beautiful place, and I have all the time, in the world just to meditate, and I wouldn't be subject to having to deal with people or really anything at all. I could just go in the morning on the alms round, get the food, that was over, the rest of the day was mine. So there I was for 6 months in an ideal place, quote, ideal, unquote. And then, of course, the things happened to me that I had very little control over. There was a cyclone, almost blew my kuti off the mountain. And it blew the kitchen cootie into mine. I was sitting right on the porch of it. The bindabata was very long. I had to leave even almost before dawn to get to the place where people could offer food. You're so far away from any village. So by the time you returned, you were totally exhausted. Physically really tired from climbing up and down this mountain. Then I found out that one of the monks I was living with, I've developed a real resentment and anger towards him. Not that he did anything to deserve it. He didn't actually, but something perverse in me was making a problem up. Then I got very ill, very, very ill, and the village men came up and had to carry me down this mountain, where I had to reside in a little tin shack during the hottest season of the year, with all these little, they have these really irritating flies in time, tiny little things, and they fly into all your orifices, and they just never leave you alone. So you're out in this tin shack, with these little flies buzzing in your ears and up your nose, and if you don't dare open your mouth, they'll fly right in it. So this is really irritating. You know, this is stressful, or sick. Everything was going wrong. So then, laying there in the heat, feeling sick, and I started feeling sorry for myself. I heard an airplane fly overhead, and I thought I was going to die. You know, so I thought, I'm going to die in this remote jungle somewhere, and I could have just gone back to the United States. I could have. Why did I? What am I doing, living out here as a Buddhist monk, doing these things? And I could live a very comfortable life if I chose to. And so I start thinking about what a foolish person I am. Start disparaging myself, feeling sorry for myself. And then suddenly, an awakening moment came. In the midst of all this misery, this physical misery and the mental misery, I had this insight, and the inner voice said, stop this. So something good in me exists, you know, it does that. This happened quite a few times. It'll stop me from just sinking into this misery. So the inner voice said, stop it, you know, like that. Like a good school teacher says. And then I stopped, actually. And I sat up and started just contemplating my breath, going in and out. And that's the basic practice in the monasteries, Anapanasati. So I hadn't done any during this time. I was just so wretched. And just felt I can't do that anymore, and everything seemed just too much to bear. But then the point came, and I stopped creating stress onto the stressful situation. So that was an insight into the way it is, where we don't have control of the environment, that much control over it, but we do have a choice in regards on our attitude towards it. And that became really clear in that moment, because that's what we call an insight moment, where you have a vivid memory of that. I think I've mentioned this in some of the books, but this particular moment registered very strongly. So it wasn't just a kind of thing I forgot. It really stuck in my mind. And so just by going back to the breath, and stop doing all this mental, stressful mental proliferation, then I found I could bear the physical part of it. The little flies, the heat, the fever, whatever, it was all, you know, that's something quite bearable, I found. But if I wasn't creating stress onto it, if I wasn't resisting, being averse, feeling sorry, if I wasn't feeling sorry for myself, or wishing I was somewhere else, or blaming the conditions on whatever, that side of life, the actual realities of life that we bear with, are bearable. You know, there we develop endurance, patient endurance. In a monastery, and especially like in northeast Thailand, so much of the training was just basically patient endurance. Because in when you come from a middle-class background like my own, where you expect everything to be more efficient and get what you want immediately, in the forest monasteries, it's not possible. You have to learn to wait and be patient. Meditation itself, the practice of meditation, is the main factor, really, is developing patience, learning to endure the physical side as well as the mental, the way your mind works, the things it throws up into consciousness, the the kind of character tendencies that you have, that you might not like it all, or you resist in every way possible. So patience is Kanti Barami. It's one of the barometers, or one of the virtues that's encouraged to be developed in by the Lord Buddha. Modern life does not encourage patience. You know, you're going to fly to, like tomorrow I'm going to Italy. And I can imagine what it would be like if I go to Stansted tomorrow morning and the plane takes off late. You know, even if half an hour late, everybody's going to be grumbling. Because they say, oh, you know, Britain Airlines, you know, they never get things, leaves on time, and you can't trust it. And the mind goes into that mode of complaining about having to wait for something, even if it's not very long. Because we expect things to be on time. I expect everything to be efficient, and they should be. Yes, I agree. Airlines should be efficient, leave on time, and not cause people the stress of just, you know, making them wait too long. That's the ideal. So, but then the realities of life are dependent on so many other factors, not on an ideal, but things that are actually happening here and now. In a more primitive way of life, like the forest monastery in Thailand, life was down to a very simple way of living, with no technology. If they gave you a paraffin lamp, one of these cheap little lamps, you know, with a wick in it, and you put paraffin and light it, you felt you were really, you know, one of the more fortunate monks. The monasteries in those days were so poor, You'd look around for the you know, candles that had been burnt down, take those stubs, and anything that could shed light was treasured. I remember somebody gave me a toothbrush, and I kept that for years, the same toothbrush. Things were, you know, everything had seemed to be heightened because one couldn't take it for granted, and what you did have, say, like even a toothbrush or a paraffin lamp, was something you valued because you weren't expecting very much. Your demands on life were minimal, and so the what you did have had a significance to it, and you took care of it. Modern life is very wasteful, you know. So here in England, you know, it's been the first country to, you know, that started the Industrial Revolution. So Britain has been producing and manufacturing items for longer than any other country. So there's an incredible amount of junk in this country. And you know, you've got second-hand shops everywhere, and you know, you can buy really nice things that nobody wants anymore, clothes or furniture or whatever, because we don't treasure what we have. We're not, the society doesn't encourage that patient endurance, but encourage it to keep the economy going, for us to be discontented, to create stress around last year's fashion or last year's refrigerator. I even know a woman whose father is a sells plumbing in Zurich. And she says, some people are so wealthy in Switzerland that every couple of years they change the plumbing in their bathrooms. They get tired of the same toilet. I'm certainly not going to develop patient endurance now. stress from outside, because we can adapt to it, is, you know, recognizing that we do things that are stressful. Like last May, a year ago last May, I went to Tibet. So I went on this pilgrimage around Mount Kailash. And that was this remote mountain, holy mountain in Tibet. And to get there, you have to sit in a Land Rover for days on end, on bumpy, or there's hardly any roads in Western Tibet. So everything's dusty and bumpy, and the food was not very good. And then you get to the place where you start the pilgrimage around the mountain. It takes about 4 days for someone like myself to walk around it's like a stupa, like a teddy, you walk around this holy mountain. And on this walk, you have to go up, to higher elevations, and the oxygen diminishes, and you're always in Tibet, most of the time you're in Western Tibet, you're above 5,000 meters all the time. And if your body's not used to it, it's really stressful feeling of, just not getting enough oxygen, and you get tired very quickly. So that was stress, physically stressful. But actually, that was bearable. I found, that with I like challenges like that, where the worst thing I can think of is sitting in a centrally heated flat in London, in just comfort for a whole lifetime, just kind of a pink cocoon of pleasure. And that to me doesn't sound like an attractive option, So, I have like these adventures where you have to stretch yourself and kind of move yourself along and do things that you wouldn't ordinarily do. So, because I volunteered for this pilgrimage, nobody was holding a gun to my head. It's something I chose to do. And I was willing to experience the physical stress involved with it. I was prepared for that. That was endurable. That's okay, really. But because the conditions were a pilgrimage, that pilgrimage isn't a stressful perception in my mind. The idea, the attitude of a religious pilgrimage inspires my mind. So I was inspired to go on this. Going to a place like, a country like Tibet, which is a Buddhist country, which is quite well known these days, the Dalai Lama, this sense of people live a life based on Buddhist principles, where most of the people have this sense of devotion. And that's also been put under stressful, has been treated very badly, through the government, the Chinese government, where they've been persecuted, abused, and for years now, for 40, 50 years. So the Tibetans themselves have been under an enormous amount of stress from the government. And yet, on this pilgrimage, it was the Wesak time. The Tibetans were coming to Mount Kailash. I think the Chinese have kind of eased up on Tibet because, in the area around Mount Kailash, you could hardly see any presence of the Chinese military or anything. But there were thousands upon thousands of Tibetans coming from all over. It's such an enormous country, Tibet. And they'd come in these trucks on the backs of lorries, open where they would sit, whole villages, I'm sure, of Tibetans would be in the back of these trucks, and then all this dust and sand blowing over them. They all seem having a good time. They're kind of people that know how to enjoy life, even when it's miserable. But also, they were going to Mount Kailash. So going to Mount Kailash is another inspiring perception. Going to Mount Kailash is a place where the Lord Buddha is supposed to be at the top of it, as a myth. The Hindus believe it's the home of Lord Shiva. It's a, you know, it's an incredibly beautiful mountain. It's like, it's not one of the highest Himalayan peaks. It's not that high, but it's a very beautiful shape. It looks like a dome. It's quite symmetrical for a mountain. And it does have a special quality to it. You know, so when you're there in this high plateau, high elevation, no trees in sight, in this kind of lunar landscape, and where the colors are heightened, the skies are incredibly blue, and every color seems to be set off in its beauty, just because of the cleanness of the air, the altitude, the scene itself it hasn't been despoiled yet. It's not a popular tourist place. You don't find it littered with Coke bottles or McDonald's styrofoam holders or anything. And then the people's attitude was one of devotion. They were all going there, not because it was to have a good time in a relaxed atmosphere, but because they were going to go through a very, quite physically difficult climb around this mountain and experience hardship, physical hardship. But the mental attitude towards that was not of resistance or aversion, but of real faith and devotion. They feel the presence of the Buddha there, or the sacredness of the holy mountain. They feel transformed through that. So the kind of pettiness of their life, the problems of life, the difficulties that they might have suddenly diminish considerably when you're in a situation like that. For myself, just walking around that Mount Kailash, you know, I didn't have time to think about myself as a person at all, or think about any problems that I might have or might have not yet resolved in my life yet. It was down to basics, like taking the next step forward. Simple kind of a physical act, like walking. And even though the food I found that was given, because we can't eat in the evening, then they give us this packed lunch before noon. And it was not very appetizing. So you get a kind of a piece of dried bread, it's a bit stale or tasteless, and a hard-boiled egg and a boiled potato, something like that. And then I find at high altitudes my appetite goes anyway. So first couple of days I could stuff it down, you know, out of just sheer willpower. After that I couldn't even do that. So I don't know how I got around that mountain. I shouldn't have, because I hardly ate anything. And yet the level of inspiration was there. Also, you were surrounded by all these Tibetans who were doing that. And their attitude was rejoicing, of devotion. You know, their whole, that was uplifting, to be with those pilgrims. We were all doing it together. And so you were with people who had faith and devotion, and that seemed to have a very good effect on me. I could forget about, you know, my physical problems, or, you know, stop the mental proliferations that I could create. I didn't grumble or complain or anything. I didn't feel like it. Everything was, I felt so inspired and privileged to be able to do this, to be able to be a part of this pilgrimage. So the attitude changed, you know, from one from where the physical situation is difficult, then it's easy to complain about it. But because the conditions there were not encouraging towards that. The training of the mind, all these years of meditation, I don't you know, the tendency to complain falls away. I don't create stress through complaining. You know, so I used to be a great complainer, you know, because you're brought up to complain and find fault with things. And the society I'm from complains all the time. So, I mean, it's part of a cultural pattern that I acquired through cultural conditioning. But in the practice of meditation, you can see the suffering that comes through wallowing in negative mental states and just, a fairly innocent act of complaining or grumbling about things. How these things become habit and we become aligned with them. Cultures can indulge in negative thought patterns, and that does have an effect on how we perceive experience and ourselves. So the awareness then, this Buddha, in his emphasis on mindfulness, with this awakened attention to life. It's always interesting how many people in the West pick up Buddhism as a kind of negative religion, talking about suffering and old age, sickness and death. So we contemplate the experience of consciousness and a lifetime, human lifetime, with life experience is old age, sickness and death, isn't it? We get... These needn't be considered morbid or negative states unless we take those perceptions and somehow dwell on them in a negative way, the way we hold them, seeing it as something bad or unwanted or unfair, or we blame it, not want old age, sickness or death. Loss of the loved, the injustices, unfairnesses that everyone's experiences in life. Like in Tibet, I mean, I'm sure those Tibetans, you know, had plenty to complain about, much more than I ever could imagine. And yet that wasn't what they were doing. You know. They weren't indulging in complaining about the Chinese or being suppressed or abused or tortured. They were completely with what they were doing in this pilgrimage around the mountain. In modern society, you know, it's materialistic societies like this one. It's the experience of we have high expectations and demands, and we learn to complain a lot. And we can imagine always things being better than what they are. We can be self-critical, like dwelling on your shortcomings or your faults as you see them. This creates stress. To always be self-critical, to see yourself in through negative habits, creates stress. You can never be good enough, never be successful enough. In the world, because the habit pattern will always make some comment, you know, maybe negative comment internally. People have to work in stressful environments, you know, with people that don't understand them or don't like them, that are jealous or envious or who, you know, have grudges, have their own problems in life and then kind of project them onto you. So in society and in families and social situations, they can be quite threatening because we are subject to being criticized or put down in some way or diminished through what somebody says to us or how they might look at us or receive us or refuse to receive us. So it is important to recognize that the way out of this isn't through controlling, finding the perfect place to live, the perfect climate, waiting to meet the perfect people in the perfect profession, the perfect job, in the perfect house, in the perfect country, where everything is perfect, except on maybe virtual reality, you can do that. But I'm sure that, I don't know how long you can sustain that. Can you sustain it for a lifetime? But anyway, that's not what I would recommend, you know, living inside a kind of cocoon a fantasy world, because the real wisdom and the occasions of being human are like this. It's learning from life within these restrictions and limitations, problems, difficulties, obstructions that we have as human beings on this planet. I know people like in Thailand, for example, it's very common to want to be reborn in a deva realm, a kind of angelic realm. The idea of you know, that many people feel that maybe their possibilities of being totally liberated from suffering is so remote, like realizing nibbana. So they'll settle for like going to a deva loka. Like deva means like an angel, a very kind of ethereal being. And so an ethereal being, imagine what that is like. You know, ethereal beings don't have these kind of coarse bodies. Just think how nice it would be not to have a coarse human body. One made of ether, you know. You know, it sounds, you know, what we imagine. I can imagine an ethereal form, you know, in which I can be perfectly beautiful and useful for eons of time. And I won't have to undergo pain or hunger. The physical functions, the motions of the body will not bother me anymore, not humiliate me. Because I'm living in an ethereal realm where it's too refined for that. Because these are coarse, the bodies, aren't they? Earth, fire, water, and air impinging on each other. You know, and the chemistry that goes into that means that we're subject to all these strange movements and motions and that of a physical realm. So, an ethereal realm would be more like virtual reality, because it's a thought realm, isn't it? Thoughts are, they're quite. You can create beautiful thoughts, perfect thoughts. So then, when people say, "Well, I don't feel I could ever," I'm not. My karma in this life is so bad that I just want to be reborn as a deva in the next life. You know, so if you go to these different realms, deva realms, you can spend, 84,000 eons as in this ethereal realm, in these beautiful forms. 84,000 eons sounds like a long time. Doesn't it? You know, like, you know, I'm 70 now, so that seems like a long time. But 84,000 eons, I don't know quite what an eon is, actually. But I assume it's longer than a year. And 84,000 sounds like a lot to me. Now you could even boost it up, 84 million, you know, and whatever, trillion. But still, it's a time-based construction, isn't it? So exploring happiness, if you notice when you're happy how rapidly time flies, you know, I've discovered this, you know, when life is just so pleasant, so happy, time just zooms by. And it seems to drag when you're in pain and life is miserable. So I figured it out. I figured 84,000 eons probably goes by very quickly. because it was, it's just me too happy. You know, and you have nothing to contrast it with. So it would just maybe just be like snap of a finger. You know, you just, that's it. Any further now, I'm back. Where am I now? Anyway, that's just a reflection on, I don't know, maybe 84,000 eons is a long, long time that you can just enjoy the ethereal realm. But the Buddha did not recommend that. You know, he's pointing to liberation from time itself, from the illusions of conditioned phenomena. Not escaping conditioned phenomena, but from the illusions that we create around it. So the reality that the Buddha is pointing to doesn't need to wait for the next rebirth, next birth, the next incarnation, but it's pointing to the immediacy of the present, in which we recognize the timeless reality. And we're still incarnated in a physical form, in this body as it is. And it is the way it is, you know, with it way it is at this moment, you know, in whatever state that is, in its, in a, whatever age or sensations one is having, it's like this. And the liberation isn't being freed from all that, from having that experience, but the liberation is through the attitude towards it, changing from the clinging identity that we have with it to realizing it as the way it is. So this Pali word Dhamma then is a, you know, we use this word Dhamma, the truth of the way it is. Translate Dhamma or Dharma into English. Everything is Dharma, because everything is the way it is. And so Dharma includes everything, good, bad, right and wrong, everything. And so the body then, rather than seeing it in terms of a personal identity, is changed to seeing the Dharma, or the emotional habits we have, the way we react to life, and the kind of character, personalities we have, and so we're seen in terms of the way they are, rather than judged and evaluated according to ideas or ideals or prejudices that we might have, that we've acquired. So how to change this attitude, you know, and it's not developing another attitude, like I can tell you what the right attitude is and you just take that and do it. You know, I'm not telling you what that is, but it's awake, the essence of it is this awakening. So it's like waking up, being fully present, open to life. Not trying to avoid or escape or control anymore, but being open to one's tendencies to want to do that, the fear or the threat that one might feel towards the life that one is experiencing, or the negative states. It's not suppressing them or denying them, because that's a negative act in itself, but it's opening to it, so that this awareness is our ability to embrace the totality, to be open to the experience of consciousness and all that that implies in its positive or negative qualities. If it's all Dharma, if it's all Dhamma, then it's, you know, our attitude toward it then is of awareness. And that awareness then is Buddha. Buddha means awakened. So waking up, awakenness, to see, to know the truth of the way it is the essence of is the teaching of the Buddha. So that waking up is something that we cultivate. We aren't used to being awake. It's you know, habitual behavior, even if they're bad habits, they're easier than to develop good habits. Because if you've already developed bad habits, that's what you're used to. So good habits, you know, if you don't have very good habits, it takes a lot of effort to develop good habits, because that's not what you're used to. You might want to have good habits, but it's not, you know, but if one's experience of life has been conditioned through bad habits, bad, you know, negative ways of thinking or reacting to life, then, you know, you may not want to be the way you are or like your habits or approve or justify them, but they're the easiest thing to follow because they're habitual. How many of you ever asked yourself, why do I have to act like this? I know better. When somebody hurts my feelings, why do I act like this? You know, that's stupid, you know, the way I get hurt and feel so upset and it, you know, I shouldn't be doing this. This is a bad habit. But then if that's a habit and somebody insults or hurts my feelings, then this is what the way it is. So the attitude then is one of awareness, not criticizing or making some value judgment about it being bad or unsatisfactory or stupid or childish, but recognizing, realizing it's like this. So it's Dhamma rather than some kind of personal defect. As soon as you claim it personally, then it's more than what it is. It's no longer Dhamma. It's my problem, my habit, my stupidity. So this takes an alertness and a patience so this attention, awakeness, patience, enduring, learning to bear with physical discomfort and emotional stress and pain. Not by just gritting your teeth and trying to prove that you can take it, because then that's a willful act that it's non-sustainable. Sometimes it's impossible to endure just through being very willful about it. But what is possible, what is within our ability to sustain through misfortune and tragedy and that is the attitude we have towards it, towards this openness to it, willingness to experience it, willingness to allow it to be what it is. It's an act of faith, you know, and trust that I'm pointing to. It's an imminent act. It's a movement away from the momentum of habit, not by suppressing or denying, but by embracing them. So you begin to recognize this just through simple practices of your own. Just in your life with your family, your children, your profession, whatever, that your situations you're in, the difficulties of your life, the problems that you have, this all can be seen in terms of Dharma rather than seen as in terms of some my problem. So I want to encourage this. This is what like the Amravati, this monastery here, it's a place for this kind of encouragement. You know, I teach the same thing all every day, all the time. But because there's, you know, it's what I can offer to remind you, because we do forget. So easy to get pulled back into the old habit. You know, it's so easy. It's the power of emotion. Emotion has tremendous power and it just pulls us. It seems so strong, so real. And yet, every moment that your emotions are strong, like that, if you just trust yourself to just step back a little, you know, rather than try to get rid of them, recognize them. It's like this. Feeling angry or feeling offended, feeling hurt is like this. Feeling impatient and resentful is like this. Feeling frightened and threatened is like this. Just a simple way of looking and trying to remind yourself of, even if you can't sustain it, just getting the idea, kind of letting it sink in and working with it in a very patient way, you'll begin to appreciate this ability we have, that each one of us has. So in terms of meditation, this is what the point is, you know, not to as the Buddha said, not to gain the high levels of concentration and the supernatural powers and all this, but the unshakable liberation of the heart. So this unshakable liberation of the heart is what we align ourselves when we wake up to life. So you can see the Buddha isn't asking us to just see life through negative perceptions of suffering, old age, sickness, and death, because that would be depressing. You know, if that's all, you know, life is a drag, you know, let's face it. Like the, you know, Jean-Paul Sartre or somebody like that, life is just, you know, unfair and it's a bummer. So you just put up with it, you know. It's not a liberating attitude. You know, you're just going to get depressed, you'll fall and sink into depression. But he's pointing to this ability we have to learn from this, from everything that we experience, from life itself, from our karma, from the way things happen to us in whatever good forms or bad forms that we might experience them. Nothing is wasted. There isn't anything that isn't the Dharma. So then when we recognize this, then and not just intellectually, as you test this out in your daily lives, then you begin to know this for yourself, not just accept these words or believe it, but you begin to, through your own investigation, recognize the truth of the way it is. So now I'll stop here, and it's 3 o'clock and the tea has arrived, so I invite you all to have a cup of tea, and then in about 20 minutes, I'll ring the bell, and those of you interested can come back and have a discussion around this subject.